Revelation chapter 13. Was enraged at the woman and went off to make war against the rest of her offspring, those who obey God's commandments and hold the testimony of Jesus. Satan, the great dragon, makes war against the church, against the woman, and he makes war against the woman's children. Is to say, against believers, against the members of the church. Satan, we talked about it this morning. Here it is again in the book of Revelation. Satan is making war against the church and against all believers. And then in chapter 13, we see how Satan makes war upon the church. How Satan makes war against us. The dragon, chapter 13, verse 1, stood on the shore of the sea. Satan stands on the brink of the great deep, where the nations of the world are swirling around. And out of the abyss, he calls forth a beast, a monster. I saw a beast coming out of the sea, a beast with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 crowns on his horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. Out of the swirling depths of history, out of the movements of the nations, emerges a monstrous animal, a horrible beast. It's a state. It's an empire. It's the fourth of the beasts that Daniel saw in his vision back in Old Testament times. It's the Roman Empire. It's that great superstate. It has 10 horns. It's got enormous power at its disposal, enormous strength. It can fight on many different fronts. And it has 7 heads. John, in his lifetime, is going to see 7 different Roman emperors, and they're here pictured as 7 heads. Each of these 7 heads is one more manifestation of the monster's aggression and cruelty, and even the horns of the beast are crowned. This beast, the Roman Empire, is the successor to other empires. It resembles a leopard, verse 2, because it's as swift moving as the Greek Empire, which Daniel described as a leopard. And it's as huge and sprawling and vast as a bear, because it's the successor to the Persian Empire, which Daniel described as a bear. And it's got a mouth like that of a lion, because it's as ferocious and vicious as the Babylonian Empire, which Daniel described as a lion. The Roman Empire combined in itself all the most terrifying, all the most horrible features of the great empires that had gone before it. People to whom John wrote this book, the people to whom he first sent it, had to live in the dominion of the beast. They had to live in the Roman Empire. They had to live in a world dominated by the Roman superstate, by this monstrous beast with all its power and all its ferocity and all its persecuting determination. We said last week that the Roman Empire must have seemed utterly indestructible. Verse 3, there was a time when people thought that the beast, the Roman Empire, was finished. After Nero's death, after Nero was forced to commit suicide, the Roman Empire was plunged into chaos and civil war, and everybody thought then that the Roman Empire had died. But by the time John writes this, the Roman Empire has come alive again. It's been stabilized under another emperor, and the fatal wound's been healed, and people are saying, the Roman Empire is indestructible. Nothing is ever going to bring the Roman Empire to an end now. If it could survive the death of Nero, if it could survive that year of the most appalling civil war, then it will survive anything. The Roman Empire is here to stay. It's going to stay forever. They thought that it was indestructible. And they saw it as universal. The whole world was astonished and followed this beast. Wherever they looked, they saw the Empire of Rome extending. It seemed to be stretching out further and further and bringing all the nations and all the tribes under its own control. He said, this is the empire that is going to swallow up the whole world, the whole earth. And they saw that it was irresistible. People said, verse 4, who is like the beast? Who can make war against him? He said, there's no point in trying to fight against this super state. There's no point in trying to resist the authority of the empire and the emperors. All you can do is knuckle under. All you can do is accept the fact that this super state is going to control us all. You see, the horrible thing about the Roman Empire, the thing that made it a beast, said it last week, was the fact that the Roman Empire was put in the place of God himself. The Roman Empire was seen as more than just a convenient governmental arrangement. The Roman Empire was seen as divine. It was known as Dea Roma, the God of Rome. And each of the emperors who ruled over the empire was seen himself as divine. From Augustus onwards, each one of them was worshipped as a god. And the Roman Empire and the Roman emperors claimed the right to be worshipped by every person in the empire. They claimed the right to control every person in the empire, to control people body and mind and soul and spirit. The philosophy of the empire was this: you only exist for the state. You exist to bring honor to the emperor. You exist to serve the emperor. The emperor has absolute rights over you, over your home, over your family, over your body, over your mind. The emperor is your god, and the empire is the goddess that you serve. Just a conglomeration of human beings, headed up by one human being, the emperor in Rome, claimed to be God. They put themselves into the place of God and demanded worship. And the people who lived under the Roman Empire, almost without exception, said, we will give the worship that's demanded. Who is like the beast? Who can make war against him? If Caesar, if the emperor demands my worship, how can I refuse? If the empire demands my absolute devotion, how can I resist? There is no way in which you can resist this superstate, this superhuman entity, this God. that the beast is described as doing in verse 5. The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies. And then in verse 6, he opened his mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. His blasphemies, proud boasts, natural greatness, all his own superhuman power. The beast boasts, I can do anything. The beast says, there is no limit to my dominion or to my rights over human beings. This empire, Roman Empire, made such huge claims for itself. It claimed that it could sort out all human problems. It claimed that it could abolish all illness, that it could abolish all war, that it could abolish all human poverty. It claimed that it could bring absolute stability to the world. The Roman Empire claimed omnipotence. It spoke proud words. Meanwhile, the blasphemed God, the spoken and the true God, as someone to be despised, as someone of deceptive importance. And this is the last week. The Roman Empire never forbade anybody to worship their God. They said, worship your God, but understand that the Empire exists. Yes, you're free to serve any God you choose, but serve the Empire first. You're free to worship any God you please, but you worship him when and how we say. That is what John means when he says that the beast blasphemed God, that the great beast used God as just one more building block to the Empire's control over him. This empire, this brutal empire, to be formed.
sent all of the horses to make a war with the Philistines. Now he is dead, now he is powerless, but he can war against and the sick. And it's so many. And it's people who only desire to live for God, that shapes his land, and the empire makes war on them and conquers them. They do die. They are burnt alive, they are cast to the wild beasts. God allows it to happen, and the impression is given with nothing can prevent the empire from destroying and devouring the church. This beast rules everyone, everywhere. He's given authority over every tribe, every language and nation. Those who have been chosen, those who have been redeemed by the Lamb, those who God has bought for himself, those people will stand firm despite everything that the state can do. It's astonishing that John looks for it. He thinks of the whole influence of the Roman state. He thinks of its vast geological world. He thinks of the massive power that has at his disposal. And he thinks of the people who have been chosen by God. People whose names have been written in the book of life. People who have been redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. And yet people who are in themselves so fragile, so ordinary, those people who stand up against all the scenery of the great. To the end, and if necessary, they lay down their life, but they will not surrender. Oh, they this morning, they won't give in, they won't say yes, and the emperor is Lord. They won't bow down and say yes, we'll do whatever the empire demands. These people are solid, fight with, that stand for the Lord. This is one of the things that amazes the Roman authorities. Cross landing and to make and fall Thank you. Thank you. together because they have not gone into this tragedy. We are going to let the person all the things. I think from the country, I'm not going to talk about somebody who has to go with that to the time to and we will see the right to come to the members of this church and to come to the Lord's Day because faithfulness to Christ will come to us. And immediately, as a church, we will be able to do it.
Officers David and Carl will be in court. Or it may be that at some point, if the church grows, at some point we will seek to increase the team of leaders and workers who are employed by the church, and some state body will ask whether we are employing a proper proportion of women among our ministry team. And we'll say that the ministry team, elders of the church, must be exclusively male, because that's what faithfulness to Christ demands. And the state will say, we decide what is acceptable religion. And we are telling you that that is not an acceptable view in the 21st century. The day will come when this church will be outside the law. The day will come when the state, when the beast, will begin to impose its authority upon us. You know, the pavilion that we hire on a Tuesday evening, and now on a Wednesday evening, the lady who runs that locally is very sympathetic to us. Said, look, you know, this is how much you pay from week to week, but you can always get the money back if you like. You simply have to put an application to the community fund, and because it's a community activity, you'll get your rent back. Isn't that generous? And she meant well. She was being kind. She gave me a copy of the form, and I looked at it with David. Look through it. Do you have an equal opportunities policy as a charity? Does your organisation give a proper place to ... What policies, what are you doing to combat racism? What are you doing to combat homophobia? And so on and so forth. Yes, we'll support you, we'll encourage you, say the local authority. We'll make funds available to you, but only if you have the right attitudes. Only if you fall down and worship our set of values. The day will come when we won't be allowed to hire any public building because we don't sign up to a code of acceptable views and attitudes. One way or another, the monster, the beast, reasserts itself over against the church in different places at different times. Now, John goes on to say in verse 11, then I saw another beast coming out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon, and he exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf, and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose fatal wound had been healed. John sees a second beast coming to stand by the side of the first beast. And this second beast emerges out of the earth. The first beast had arrived from the sea. It had come from overseas, you might say. From the point of view of people living in Asia Minor, where John's readers lived, it was a foreign export. That's what the Roman state was. It had come in from the outside. But now we have another beast who doesn't come from outside. Rather, it rises up from the earth. It's local. It's indigenous. And this beast, this second beast, is very different in appearance from the first beast. It's so friendly. It's got two horns like a lamb. Nothing threatening at all. Nobody feels threatened by a lamb with its horns. Little innocent things. This is a friendly, pleasant, gentle, caring little beast. But he spoke like a dragon. Once he opens his mouth, and once you hear what he's saying, then you realize that the lamb-like outward appearance is all a facade. That really he's got the nature of a dragon underneath. This beast is as much satanically inspired as the first beast. He's as venomous and fierce and vicious as the first beast and as the dragon. Now, what is the role of this first beast? Of this second beast? The second beast is to exercise all the authority of the first beast on his behalf. The role of this second beast is to make sure, locally, that the will of the first beast is actually carried out. That the authority of the first beast is actually submitted to. The role of this second beast is to make the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast. Do you see what John is talking about here? The Roman superstate, the Roman Empire is one thing, but it's based in Rome. That's where its seat of power is, hundreds of miles away from Asia Minor in Rome. So how can the Roman Empire make sure that its authority is actually upheld locally? How can it make sure that people in Asia Minor do worship it as they're supposed to? Well, by having another beast, a local beast, to enforce its will and its dictates. John is writing here about all the local machinery that enforces the will of the superstate. He's talking about all those political and religious and economic institutions that existed in Asia Minor that ultimately served the cause of the Roman Empire and made sure that the authority of the Roman Empire was actually put into practice locally. There was a council known as the Council of Asia, and it was made up of representatives from all the chief cities of Asia Minor. And basically, it ran everything that went on in Asia Minor. It oversaw the economy of the province. And it oversaw all the social institutions of the province. And above all, the Council of the Commune of Asia made sure that the emperor and the empire were worshipped. It was they who set up the temples to the emperors. It was they who set up the statues of the temple, the statues of the emperors in the temples. And it was they who made sure that all the ordinary people of Asia Minor did come and worship in those temples and bow down before the statues. There was this whole local network of people whose job it was to make sure that the power of the Roman Empire was really effective on a local level and that nobody could evade it. That everybody had to worship the Roman Empire locally. The head of the Commune of Asia, this council, was a man called the Asiarch. And as well as being the head of the council, he was also the high priest of the goddess Roma. And the Emperor Caesar Augustus, son of God. So do you see, you've got a local council that runs the whole of the province of Asia, and who is the man who runs the council? He's the man whose first great title is High Priest of the Goddess Rome. High Priest of the Emperor Caesar Augustus, son of God. That's what he's there for. He's there to make sure that the empire and the emperor is worshipped. Later on, in the book of Revelation, this second beast is going to be described as a false prophet. Because that's exactly the role he plays. A god or a goddess needs to have prophets to speak for it. And so this second beast acts as the false prophet speaking for the emperor and the empire locally. Wherever you have a superstate spread over a huge area, you also have to have a network of bureaucrats and state employees who make sure that the will of the empire, of the superstate, is worked out to local level. Again, it's what we're seeing in the Western world. Larger and larger and larger proportion of working people are employed by the state. And so many of them are employed by the state, not for any productive work, but simply to make sure that the will of the state is performed. You think of the social workers, and you think increasingly of the role that the police play, and you think of many school teachers, and you think of the community workers, and you think of civil servants. And so many of these people would say, the real heart of our job now is simply to try and help people to behave in the way the state wants them to behave. To enforce proper attitudes. To educate people into the right way of thinking. To make sure that the dictates that come down from on high are applied locally. So if the government decides that every family will be banned from smacking their children, then immediately we will need to have a whole new body of bureaucrats, won't we? To go into homes and to investigate and to check up what's going on and who's and which parents are slapping their children and to keep the registers of wicked parents and vulnerable children. We'll need a whole new body of public employees just to make sure that the commands of Caesar are put into practice in your home. That's what John's talking about. When he talks about this second beast, he's talking about all the network of a local bureaucracy that's given authority by the state to enforce its dictates. Does all this ring true in our society? As I say, we aren't at Rome at Revelation 13 yet. The state in our country is still a state which is restrained by some safeguards. Have to be aware of the fact that the things that John is describing are more and more the direction in which life in the Western world is moving. I've run out of time, and we've not come to the end of the chapter. We'll return to these things next week. What are we tonight? What are we here in Stockport in 2001? How are we going to benefit from reading this chapter? Well, first of all, our hearts surely ought to be filled with amazement and wonder and admiration at the grace of God that has protected and preserved the church all through the centuries. Isn't it amazing? that these, that this rampaging monster worm and his slimy-tongued serpentine mate, that they have sought in all centuries and in all places to crush the church, and they failed. You know, you think of, let's say, the power of the Stalinist state, and you think of just the different groups of people and the different institutions that Stalin did succeed in crushing out of existence. He had the military and political machinery of the state at his disposal, and he had the propaganda machine, the false prophet, at his disposal. And using those things, he was able to crush all opposition. Anybody whom he saw as a threat was just ruthlessly liquidated. And yet there was one body of people whom he never liquidated, because the more of them he killed, the more they multiplied. And the more he tortured them, the more bravely and the more faithfully they stood up. If the Church of Jesus Christ, this vulnerable woman, assaulted by the dragon, trampled by the beast, and lied to by the false prophet, and yet she rises above it all, still faithful to Christ, individual believers, and still continue faithful to the end, kept by the power of God, kept holy, kept faithful, kept wise, kept prayerful, kept obedient, still serving the Lord Jesus. Be filled with wonder and admiration. It is the standing miracle of history that after 2,000 years of persecution by the most appalling and brutal states, after 2,000 years of facing the hatred and the cruelty of men, the Church of Jesus Christ still stands in every continent and every nation and every island. It's still reaching out to win even the unreached tribes. Nothing has ever stopped it. And then secondly, feel a sense of compassion and concern, remembering that there are still many believers who are living under the shadow of the monster today. And we might not yet be seeing the full hatred and the venom of a monster superstate. There are many believers who are. To be a believer today in North Korea, or in China, or in Myanmar, is to live in a country where the state still demands absolute worship, and where a person who says, "My first allegiance to Jesus Christ," that person is immediately in danger of being tortured and killed. Feel for your fellow believers who feel themselves trapped by a network of informers and spies and bureaucrats who want to intrude into their homes and examine everything they do, and who want to read their minds and check them out for their thought crimes. Could you live in a world like that? Some of you have read that frightening novel 1984, which is Orwell's picture of the totalitarian state, the monster. And the pressure of living in a world where every thought of yours is open to the examination of the authorities, where they never stop watching you. But there are believers who are in that situation today. To be a believer in Iran today is to live in that atmosphere, knowing that on every street there are secret police who can't be identified, but who are watching you and taking note of when you leave the house and when you come in and who you talk to, and are listening to every conversation. Can't pick up the phone without being afraid that it's bugged. There are believers who have to live under those pressures. Not only are threatened by the first monster, but always hear the second monster, the the dragon-mouthed lamb padding up behind them. And thirdly, be prepared. Examine yourself. In the end, when persecution does come, and I believe it will, as I say, unless God sends great awakening and revival to the Western world, when persecution comes, the only thing that will keep you from falling down and worshipping the beast, the only thing that will keep you from compromising and doing what everybody else is doing, will be if you have such a love for Christ that you can't bear the thought of giving worship and loyalty to anybody or anything else. That was what kept these believers. That is what kept believers during those Marian persecutions. That's what kept believers at the height of the Stalinist purges. The fact that they loved Christ. And that when people said to them, you must bow down and worship and do what the state demands, they said, we can't. Because that would be unfaithfulness to Christ. And we love him too much to give our loyalty to anyone else. Do you have that sort of love for Christ? I'm not asking, do you have the physical courage that it would take to stand up to torture? I'm asking, do you have the sort of love for Christ which would make you say, he must always come first for me. He must come before society. He must come before career. He must come before safety. Christ must come first. Jesus is worthy to receive honor and power divine. And Jesus is worthy to receive the unreserved, unshared love of your heart. Jesus demands and Jesus deserves not that you love him more than your family, not that you love him more than society, not that you love him more than career. Jesus simply demands that you love him totally and entirely, and he deserves that sort of love. For his sake you love men and women around you, and for his sake you'll love your family, and for his sake you'll seek to be a good citizen. But it's he himself who must capture your heart. You must love him. That's the only thing that will preserve you. When persecution comes, say it again, no physical courage will keep you. No great high principles will keep you then. No noble, I'm too dignified to bow down and compromise will keep you then. The only thing that will keep you then will be if you have a heart that's burning with love for the one whose heart burned with love for you. He loved you. He loved you enough to hang on a cross for you. He loved you enough to endure the darkness for you. He loved you enough to take the whole weight of the Father's anger in your place. And now he says, do you love me? Do you love me? Well, let's search our hearts and let's be sure that Christ does have our first love. And thus let's prepare ourselves for the day when we may be asked to confess him before a hostile world. May God speak to our hearts through his word. We'll sing together.